It's Wednesday, March 21st, 2012, and you're listening to episode 262 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 10 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
This is John.
And this is Chris.
First round of the Power 16-3 is done.
Oh, I can't wait
to hear this.
Let's work through the winners.
I voted at least 5 times today.
I've voted like the Ennies. That will never get old.
Chad, I'm very disappointed you voted only 5 times. However, let me go through the winners. Do you have only 5 computers? Don't you know how to cycle your IP address using proxy?
I've heard about such things.
Do you know how many computers with unique IDs Anheuser-Busch has that I have access to?
Yes.
Exactly one any of computers.
Yes, so. It is one any power of computers.
Any computer will do. All right, so let's go through the winners here. And of course, this is going to set up the next round. The next round will be open for voting as soon as this episode drops and will run for 2 weeks thereafter.
Did we think to do this during March Madness, or is this a complete coincidence?
This actually was a complete coincidence.
Okay, March Madness.
All right, so
first off,
Shadow Rifts League, let you guys guess, Dan's Free Candy Van versus Master Three Balls.
I'm going with Master Three Balls. My character, baby. NPC, MTB.
I did not vote for Master Three Balls.
I voted for it 15 times. You suck it hard.
No, I think that would be Master Three Balls that would suck.
No, he just watches.
Oh, he just watches. Oh, yeah.
Were you even listening?
Right. No, not really.
It's not creepy because he's just watching.
Oh, by the way, I have to say, I love the description of Master Three Balls that you gave in the voting because it was maybe only about 10% correct. So, but that's all right. Go ahead.
Wait, what 10%? It's creepy. That was true. It came from Chris. That's true.
That's true.
Okay, that was redundant. Also true. But it's some sort of D&D character that has 3 testicles and likes to stare at naked women played
human
by
women.
Chris's job.
That's important that he was a halfling who liked human women only.
Well, what has been inaccurate so far? You're bitching about insufficient. What has been inaccurate here?
It's an insufficient amount of detail.
Was he a D&D character?
He was an NPC. He was an actual
character. Why does that part matter?
Is the C in NPC?
Was he a D&D character, yes or no?
He was an NPC.
Did he have 3 testicles?
He did indeed.
Did he like to stare at naked women?
Only human women. The other ones he had nothing to do with.
So that's yes.
Oh gosh, me too.
So was this character
now suddenly he's not so creepy. John Lynch.
Was this woman played by a jock friend of yours?
Well, I guess he. Well, I think when you say
that's
jock,
yes. Yeah. Continue. Okay.
So by 10%, you mean 100%. All right. In our math, that zero
Who
means
won
something.
The damn thing?
All right, 68.2 to 31.8%. Master Three Balls won.
Sorry to say. Victory.
Number 2, the Pat Soundboard versus Boots the Pegasus.
Pat Soundboard.
79.1% to 20.9%. It was the Pat Soundboard. Number 3, Battletech versus Episode 200. This was a close one.
Ooh. Episode 200.
I'm going to go with Battletech
Episode
on this
200.
One.
53.1% to 46.9% is episode 200.
Yes! Yes.
I mean, that's terrible.
That's like a,
that
that's
we
like
haven't
a seven,
released
eight
that
seed.
Yet, but
Uncle Flo versus Gnarlgate.
Uncle Flo.
I'm hoping Uncle Flo.
I'm going to go with Uncle Flo.
Uncle Flo.
66.7% Gnarlgate.
Wow.
Wow.
We didn't vote enough, Chad.
Apparently not.
Another close one, Stanley L. Jackson versus the Time Cube AI. And by the way, the winner on this one actually shifted back and forth several times.
I'll go Stanley L. Jackson.
Yeah, I'm with Chad on this one. Stanley L.
I'm tired of all these snakes in this poll.
Time
Stanley
Cube
L. Jackson.
John is right. 52.5 to 47.5% the Time Cube AI.
I was actually really pulling for both there. I didn't have a problem with either one winning.
That's one of those tough ones, though. I do agree with you.
And I voted 4 different day periods.
The description.
Each side of the Time Cube.
I wrote the description for all these things. The Time Cube AI is the only one I didn't write. I took it straight off of his website.
Are you going to
It was the first quote on his website. And this is one sentence, by the way. Magnificent, supernatural, more powerful than a god, you are retarded.
Now, Dan, when he goes up again, you need to do a different quote.
I will find like another quote off of his site. Maybe like the second line down. All right. Number 6. The Seasons Game versus Grandma Nazi.
Seasons.
That's kind of weak.
Well, I'm pulling for Grandma.
Grandma Nazi.
I'm pulling for Grandma, but
I've never even heard of the Seasons game.
I
don't think anyone
cares. You ran it. It just sounded good.
It was a new one on me, too, but apparently other people have heard of it. 69.6% to 30.4 Seasons game.
Wow.
That's a great percentage.
All righty. The hell is this?
It's your paper!
Oh, well, it cut off in printing. Bill Cosby versus the Princess Party. Another close one, surprisingly.
I'll go with the Cos.
I'll say Cos.
54.5% Bill Cosby to 45.5% Princess Party.
Is this going
to
be Cos versus Master Three Balls by the end?
Oh, that would be a that would be a battle extraordinaire.
Well, actually, it is set up such that we could end up with Pat versus John. So.
Could be Pat Soundboard versus John GMBot?
John GMBot.
Wow. What happens when you plug the two together?
John GMBot versus Aaron Stack's Petty Little Victories.
Beep, boop, vote for
beep,
me.
Boop, boop, boop. John GMBot.
75.1% to 24.9%.
It's printing out a ticket.
Okay,
all die.
I want to see Master Three Balls go against episode 200. So we've got two things that Chris was working on that we won't ever have any firsthand experience with.
John GMBot gets one experience point for surviving a life-threatening encounter.
So we are
John GMBot is harsh.
We are finally doing
I programmed it myself.
We're going to do the episode on faith, and I've got all kinds of thoughts here about faith as it's handled within the course of a role-playing game, and I hope I don't need this disclaimer this far into our show's run, but I'm going to get a bit anyway. We are talking about faith as a mechanic or as a role-playing trait within a role-playing game. Obviously, depending on the game, that can imply a real religion. All the commentary here is purely within the context of a role-playing game. Please keep your forum posts and such within that stream as well. And please interpret other people's posts as well. All right, so with that said, before we get into our actual thoughts on how to use faith in games, I mean, we try to be system agnostic, but we'll look at how faith is handled in a couple different RPGs, just sort of examples and base points here. But before we get into that, I have to stump my human supremacy here for a little bit, because I have determined that there is a pretty clear moral striation within urban fantasy. It's a little bit fuzzier within traditional fantasy, but in urban fantasy, you basically have three groups of people, and only the humans are the good guys. You have those that are evil and prey upon humanity. You have those that are supernatural, but know enough that at possible risk to themselves, they could expose those that are predating upon humans. And then you have the humans who are either the victims or the resistance. And therefore, as far as I see it, you basically have the evil, the Vici, and the humans.
But where's the evidence to support any of this, Dan? How much urban fantasy are you familiar with? Because that does not match most urban fantasy. That may be true of World of Darkness, but that's it. I can't think of another urban fantasy setting that that's the case.
And I can't think of much urban fantasy where there's an active human resistance.
Okay.
Wayne, in Dresden Files, are there vampires that prey upon humanity?
Yes.
If you were somebody who is a good mage, you can play a good mage, right?
Yeah.
Could you go on TV, throw a fireball, convince everyone this is real, and tell them that the vampires are out there?
If you attempted to do that, you would be killed by the other mages for revealing magic.
Right.
But the point is, yes, you can.
You could.
People don't want to believe it, though.
But that's not answering my question here. If you can get on TV and throw a fireball, yes, you will lose your life. But in the process, how many thousands, if not millions, will you save? Either from death, decay, social manipulation, political manipulation, etc.
Why do you need to be a magic user to do it? Why can't you be a person and go on and stake a vampire on TV? You don't need to be magical for that to happen.
Good point. And I think if somebody has the capacity to do that and doesn't, I would put them in the same category.
There's a character who tries at the very beginning of Dresden Files. She runs a tabloid that everyone just blows off, but she rolls with Dresden and sees it all happen.
Yeah. People don't want to believe that. People are better off not believing it in most cases. If you know about it, you're then involved in it and you're more likely to become a victim. You're not doing people favors by revealing it in most urban fantasy worlds. Most urban fantasy worlds also have governing bodies and rules set in place. So, well, yeah, there are bad guys, there are evil, and there are people that are out there preying on, you know, other people. Well, they're not just preying on humans. They're also preying on other beings and things like that.
One thing that I would say is a general trend, and this is not obviously true of all urban fantasy, but one thing that is a general trend within urban fantasy is there is no large-scale reveal, that at no point does society as a whole find out it's real. Now, of course, in Vampire, you have that described as the masquerade. Well, but
even necessarily the case, because there's a lot of urban fantasy that there is a big reveal. Urban fantasies, they know that their vampires are real. Let's look at True Blood and the Anita Blake series.
The Southern Vampire Chronicles or True Blood, that is the driving theme the vampires have come out of
the closet. My wife has at least five other urban fantasy series partially about they are out in the
public. Well, let's look at True Blood. What is the True Blood?
It's fake blood.
Exactly. Yeah. The point of it is there's a big reveal, at which point the predation supposedly stops. Now, obviously, the story is more complex than that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the point is that the reveal leads to the predation stopping. And in most urban fantasy, or at least the stuff I've heard, I realize there are examples where it's the other way around. You know, there's this.
And actually, in True Blood, it gets reversed. Humans feed on the vampires because their blood is like a drug.
Exactly.
It's like super acid.
Yeah.
Not saying that the vampires are good or should be sympathized with. Again, as you said, it's a more complex story than that.
Right.
But there is an aspect of that story where they are kidnapped and farmed. And
in the case of the Dresden Files, one of the big reasons why this never does get brought out into the open is because everyone in the magical world sees humans as the nuclear option.
Yeah.
If you reveal to the mundanes that these things exist, they're going to go hunt them down because there are more of them and they have guns.
Yeah.
And that means even if you're a good mage, they're going to come hunt you down because you're different and you have powers and they don't.
In something like
Interest of self-protection, you either A, allow them to keep being the victim, or maybe you do what you can to limit the damage that's being done.
Well, and that's just Dresden. In Nightwatch, it's a different dynamic.
Right.
Nightwatch is pretty interesting because you have the light and the dark. And as the story progresses, it's revealed to you that light and dark does not mean good and evil. It's just different philosophies on freedom and order. It's not good and evil. It's freedom and order. And one side will get stronger than the other. And they used to be revealed. They used to be out in the open. We're talking Middle Ages, you know, Dark Ages sort of thing. And they would fight each other openly. And they fought each other so much that it was bringing an end to not humanity, the world, the existence that they were fighting so much. And that they came to a truce. They set up these guidelines and rules between each other that would limit their existence.
This sounds very Hellboyish.
I can get into Hellboy.
Right.
You know I can get into stuff, but don't lose me on that track.
Right.
But
well, and that wasn't a bad comment.
No, not at all.
I was that really reminds me of a storyline out of Hellboy. But yeah, go on.
I my train of thought started going down this line. It's like, wait a minute, I need to finish I'm mid-sentence. Okay, so anyway, they come up with these rules and these guidelines, right? And during the day watch enforces those rules, and during the night watch enforces the same rules on each other. There's just different interpretations, and there's all these political things. Thing is that the rules have so suppressed those people. We're talking mages, werewolves, vampires, all the normal outrageous sort of stuff. And it's interesting. It's not that they're so much in hiding. It's just that their own rules have so suppressed them that if they reveal themselves to humanity, they're not worried about humanity overtaking them. It's just that if one side reveals itself and just explodes, they will win, because it's not about preying on humanity. It's about convincing humanity, not manipulating them, convincing humanity to agree with their philosophy, either the light philosophy, again, not good or evil, the light philosophy or the dark philosophy. And that the more people that they can convince to kind of lean over to their philosophy, the more powerful they can become to unshackle themselves from the chains that they have put on themselves so they don't destroy the world. It's a really interesting take on it.
You know, what really drove this home for me, or I guess got me thinking about it again, is a better way to put it, was I was watching the trailer for Underworld.
I'm so sorry.
Whatever the heck the most recent one is.
Tight leather clothing.
Underworld, the underwear?
Yeah.
Underpants, yeah.
Underworld, what's-her-face needs a paycheck.
The plot of it.
What?
was the setup. Okay, the setup as it's sold in the trailer.
Hey, baby, is your cable broke? The plot
was that Kate Beckinsale's character has gone into some kind of a stasis for a long period of time. When she comes out, now here's the point where you as the audience are supposed to gasp and be in horror. Humanity has found out that vampires are killing them and has basically created military forces to exterminate these things that are preying on them. And I'm supposed to root for the things that are preying on them.
Well, yeah.
If I may remind you, the home team here is me. I am a human being in real life, as is everyone listening to this show.
Yeah, but I'm supposed to root. Fantasy analog is a super powerful guy who dresses in cool coats.
Yeah. Oh, no, and hurts everyone who's ever made fun of me.
The person cheering for is the sexy hot chick. That's the plot.
Well,
dark, sexy hot chick, the setup, dark, sexy hot chick, plot.
I realize adding moral depth to Underworld was, you know,
It's just not
it's getting Playboy for the
hero
articles.
Projection is not upon the other humans, it's upon the vampires in that genre of urban fantasy, and that's why you're supposed to root for them.
You know what?
Vampire,
you're absolutely right. It's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not all vampires are made equal either. There are the vampires that don't prey on humans as well in a lot of urban fantasy. There are the ones that only drink from people that are willing, because heaven knows when they come out into the public, there are people that want that for some reason.
Bang bangers.
That's what they're called. Bang bangers.
But besides that, the most common trait I've seen in a lot of urban fantasy where they're not out in the open is that it is a very, very close balance. Basically, the vampires don't want this out in the open because people will come hunt them. But the people that are trying to hunt them now don't want it out in the open, because if they're out in the open, the vampires have no reason to hold back.
And
yes, in the end, they'll be wiped out, but thousands, millions of people will be killed in the process, turned into vampires, because at that point, it's not a balance. It's an all-out open war.
In some of them, you don't think about it in terms of if this happens, then this will happen and that will cause the death of all these people. Going back to True Blood, not Southern Vampire Mysteries. I've not read those books and I hear they're terrible, but the show True Blood, the TV show, which is really good.
Yes.
The vampires, the main spiritual force or whatever in that universe, was in hiding, and then they have come out and they are trying to get acceptance within the world. It's an analogy for homosexuality.
Yes.
And you are being in the closet and you are coming out of the closet, and people still hate you for what you are. But some people accept you. Some people accept you too much and only accept you because of what you are, not who you are. And there's all these analogies.
There's also internal struggles within that own vampire community, where some are a bit more militant than others and want to really impose themselves on there rather than just be part of society.
If I was gay, I would almost find that insulting, that my struggle for acceptance is likened to predatory monsters.
Yeah, that I had never heard that interpretation of True Blood or of...
That's from the producers.
I don't know if that's ever been put out that that's an official interpretation of it, but the overtones are very obvious for any minority group that is essentially struggling for acceptance. Is really
that's predatory monsters. Yeah.
Well, yes, that they're predatory monsters. No, of course not. But I mean, they have to put that aspect in there because, you know, they're vampires and that's just what they do.
Yeah, right. The big thing, though, Dan, is any good urban fantasy has taken the time to think about the point that you're trying to make and has worked into its fiction a reason why that is not the case.
And I recognize that there is always some reason there why that wouldn't work, because of the fact that otherwise you end up basically in my form of moral reductionism of, you know, just, look, this is what it is, you know.
Well,
there are basically the predator, the victim, and the useful idiots. And well, you are one of the three.
And just because something's a vampire doesn't necessarily mean it's a predator, depending on the urban fantasy.
Well, right, but then you fall in that useful idiot category.
Yeah, if it's the type of vampires I tend to prefer, then yeah, they're going to be a monster.
All right, now, Chad, I'll give you the final word, because I want to move on. We got a lot to talk about.
Hellboy. Fate. That's all I got to say.
Okay.
Hellboy.
If Hellboy is the final word, I'm okay with that.
Hellboy. Actually, Hellboy is interesting because we were talking about like hidden societies and rules and the sort of underground thing.
Yeah, it's Hellboy's, the government keeping it the
actually,
secret.
Actually, Hellboy is interesting because in the comic books, they're not secret. Hellboy himself was a secret only because he was a World War II sort of Nazi experiment supplanted by the U.S. government. And it was a sort of top secret thing. But as soon as he became a teenager, he was granted citizenship by the U.N. He is out there. People know who he is. He's a minor celebrity. And there's all this stuff happening. And the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defense is something that you can pick up a phone and call and say, hey, I've got werewolves in my backyard. And they're like, well, you're probably a crank. If we get a couple more reports, we might send somebody out. And that's kind of how they deal with it. And these things keep flying. It's like a Ghostbusters thing, you know, where, right. where they're like, how do you know it's the end of days?
We're ready to believe you.
Yeah. I mean, that, it's like that, too. But the spiritual stuff keeps popping up and popping up. You know, the Bible talks about, you know, in the end of days, you'll see all this weird. And it's like, gee, aren't we seeing all this weird now? It's like, here, give me another drink of that and let's not think about it. And that's kind of what it is in Hellboy, because Hellboy as a story arc and a plot is building up on this. Basically, they're destroying the Earth.
Right.
I mean, it's the old gods, Cthulhu-esque old gods are kind of coming back. And then they are at the last desperate attempt stops them and pushes them back. And then they come back and you keep losing
Sisyphus.
Yeah, you keep losing humanity or humans or the Earth, chunks of the Earth. You just keep losing it as you push them back.
The main topic we're going to talk about today is faith, either as a mechanic or as a role-playing trait within a role-playing game. Now, when I set this up, I want to be clear that we're talking about a game where faith is meaningful in that it may be expressed in role-playing, but it has an effect upon the world. Okay, for example, if you are playing a game that involves no sense of the supernatural, you're playing a game of some science fiction, okay, Star Trek, whatever, and you just happen to have a character who believes in something, but that's really just an RP trait. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a game that, one, presupposes the supernatural exists, and two, that they interfere in the world on behalf of their followers. Now, while we've been talking about urban fantasy, and certainly urban fantasy is going to be one of the places we're going to come back to in talking about this, because of the fact that things like Bram Stoker and the legends from the Middle Ages and such have really powered our vision of faith as it reflects against the supernatural in the modern age, we are really talking about any form of game that allows those two presuppositions I gave. Supernatural things exist and they interfere in the world on behalf of their followers. So this also includes standard fantasy.
D&D?
D&D is an example. D&D is not the only example. The
classical D&D pantheons are way more interventionist than anyone is in Dresden Files.
Let's start with the first approach to faith itself, which is that faith is a required part of role play, but has no specific mechanical representation, okay? Now, let me give you the example here. Let's look at D&D. We'll use D&D for this example. Clerics and paladins are required to pursue a particular god or goddess, some kind of a greater power. And from that greater power, they are given...
Unless they're the paladin of secular humanism.
Not playing that game.
I think there are, in some editions of D&D or Pathfinder's, option for clerics and paladins to be of an alignment.
Like a philosophical...
Rather, yeah, yes. I am a paladin good. I am not a paladin of any particular god.
Paladin, yes. Carl Sagan.
I will agree with what John said, that I have seen the same mechanic where that's not part of the core rules typically, but you can be the follower of a principle or an aspect rather than the follower of a specific power. But within D&D, as an example, your cleric, your paladin, whatever, is typically granted their powers in return for their service to a particular deity. But while the rules talk about how they must maintain a sense of devotion to that power, you know, it talks about that they can't do things that are wildly contrary to that deity's desires or that deity's alignment. They have to make some attempt to forward the causes of that deity. Depending on the exact version of D&D and Pathfinder you're talking about, there might be required festivals or tithes or rites for the dead they have to perform or who knows what. But ultimately, the only way that faith itself is described is that if they do not follow all of their sacraments and works, they eventually fall from grace with that deity and must do something to redeem themselves, or they enter into the ex-paladin, ex-cleric sort of rule set. But really, faith itself is never brought up. How much the person actually believes that, the strength of that belief, and the power of that belief really never comes into the game unless the game master enforces it. And on some level, I think...
So what you're saying is, like, I could be a paladin of some dwarven god who likes to drink ale, but really my character is kind of a teetotaler. I just go through the motions of doing this.
You know, or maybe
because I go through the motions of it, even though I hate the taste of booze, my ale god gives me my ale powers.
Well, and I think it says something about the deity in that case, too.
Yeah.
I mean, he has full descriptions of all of these deities in these type of games, but some of them may not care how much you believe.
I think
if you're
makes an
spreading the
character.
Word of them and you're what you're doing lines up with what they want to do,
right,
they'll be happy to just keep granting you power. They don't care if you believe in them or not, versus others would more than likely that matters more.
I don't think belief or non-belief kind of comes into it in D&D, because if it's kind of like, well, does your god exist? Whoosh, fireball, ale powers, whatever. It's like, well, yeah, that's coming from somewhere. And oh, look, there's the avatar of my god. Oh, look, there is my god coming right. down on this
there
mountain.
There are still
this
some characters
him.
Who would say, well, yeah, but wizards can do that too. And that doesn't come from any god being. I have seen the D&D universe skeptic, and he's right. wrong, which is yeah. part of the fun of it, but he's there.
I yeah. would take a slightly different approach to that, which is in my definition of faith. I hate to take this too much back to real world religion, but I don't know. I have no other will to draw from here. But the Greek word in the New Testament that we translate as faith, we tend to misunderstand a bit. The Greek word was pistis, which actually means an abiding trust in. To have faith in God,
so it's not belief. It's
just not belief,
like the
but
level.
it is a persistent trusting relationship with. So you could say, for example, the devil believes in God, but the devil does not have a redemptive faith. Okay, if you guys find, once again, I'm not trying to start a real religious thing here, but my point being that in the same way in the D&D universe, I have seen characters played where yes, the character does assent to the statement Shantia exists, but that does not mean the character is actually deeply devoted or in any kind of a willed relationship, a mental pursuit of Shantia as a person.
They're just going through the motions. Yeah,
precisely. It's a sacramental religion. It's not.
And there are some D&D gods who don't care. As yeah, long as you
I would agree.
The motions,
lots of them.
I would agree.
Yeah, lots of them don't even want your attention. The neutral ones don't care.
What I think you're trying to describe, though, Dan, is that's a difficult thing to wrap mechanics around if that is what your goal is to do. Because, you know, yes, you can lay out some tenets and the character can follow or break them as they see fit. But if you're in that tight spot where everyone's saying, we've got to run, but that true believer is like, no, we're not going to run. Because, you know, ale god is going to provide and we will have something to drink.
As much as I hate ale, and I don't really like ale god, he will provide.
Chris, you are absolutely correct. The real pickle with faith is the fact that faith, the way that we are describing it, is such an internal role-playing concept.
Right.
Saying how much faith you have is like saying, well, how much bitterness do you have or how much joy do you have?
Does it need a mechanical component?
And it may not. There are games that give it a mechanical component. We'll get to some of those in a moment. But I have played through multiple D&D campaigns, obviously. Faith does not have a mechanic in D&D, really. I mean, you could kind of reach and say, well, maybe some of these charisma or will checks or faith checks, but I really don't think they are, because at no point are they given pluses or minuses based on how much you trust?
I think one of the interpretations can be, it's like, we'll use the old standby, cure moderate wounds. Well, I lay my hands on you, I do the cure moderate wounds, but I roll really low. Well, maybe my faith isn't strong.
Precisely.
But that's so up and down and up and down and random. Shouldn't I have some say?
Exactly. Exactly. And this goes back to, I remember the role-playing game where the GM made you roll to see if you could get angry.
Yeah.
And it was like, are you serious?
I think that it just needs to be abstracted. I don't want...
But if it's abstracted, let me ask you a question.
In D&D.
Right. Well, in any game. Let's put D&D aside. If we say there is a game that fits these requirements, supernatural exists and they interfere in the world on behalf of their followers.
Sure.
And we say that faith is a necessary part of that relationship, that your faith determines your relationship.
My trust in and belief in my God.
Precisely. That you have a relationship, not a religion, so to speak.
Sure.
And the result of that relationship is going to be the willingness of something to intervene on your behalf. If there is no mechanic, and I'm agreeing with you, I don't think a mechanic is necessary. How would you as a game master measure and moderate that.
I would want, if a number was demanded, if we have to go mechanical with it for whatever reason.
No, I'm saying even no number was demanded.
Well, actually, I would say if there's a number demanded, I'd want two numbers demanded. Okay. I would want my character's faith in my God, and I would want my God's faith in me. Because I would love to play a character who had a really low faith, but his God was just like wacko about him.
You just hit on something I've been wanting to mention.
The way I would go with something like this is that clip from the movie Fright Night that I showed you, where it was established earlier in the movie that this great vampire killer, who was nothing but an actor who just did this in movies, it was told to him directly by the main vampire early in the movie, you have to have faith for this to work on me. And he made a convincing sign by busting up the dude's cross that he was holding out in front of him. Later on in that confrontation, he holds out the cross one more time. Of course, it doesn't work. The vampire reminds him of that, but then suddenly there's this change where that character, the actor guy, he gets faith, and suddenly he does believe that it's going to work, and sure enough, it does, and it repels the vampire. Putting that into a game table setting where you don't want, I wouldn't want a number, I would ask at that point in time, describe to me then why I should believe the fact that you now have faith that this works when before you did not. And it's up to the player then to say, I've seen this happen, there's no reason for me to believe that this is not going to work. In fact, it is going to work. I am ensuring that this is going to work. And you judge it on the player's conviction.
Chris, let me ask you a question. Is then the answer that you replace the mechanic with a conversation, not an
exactly.
in-character conversation, but an out-of-character conversation?
It's an out-of-character conversation where the player needs to convince the game master, or even vice versa, that this now really is where my character's at.
I could see that as a game master asking my player so often, where are you at in your faith? Because the faith is important to who you are and what you do. Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, here's the question, too. Another way to look at faith in a lot of games and a lot of settings, is it that this character has more faith, so the being is intervening more? Or is it faith itself that is
the power?
The power? Because how you approach it is dependent on that answer. In the case of D&D, it is the third party is directly intervening. And like Chad, I like his idea of how much faith does it have in you? How much faith do you have in it? And that's a completely
yes.
different concept than my actual faith that I have. That's what you're.
Let me hit both your guys' points and agree with both of them. Chad, I can think of, and I'll keep this purely to fictional things, but I can think of games I've run where a character really believed in a deity, but the deity was not doing a whole lot in return. Mm-hmm. And I can think of games as well I've run. I mean, coming up in our upcoming Pathfinder game that we're doing amongst the hosts online, Chris, I think it's you. Your character is currently being shot by Malar, the beast god, because you are so close to him that he basically sees a potential follower there, and you're being shot by him even though you have no allegiance to Malar whatsoever. But he's kind of pursuing you, so to speak. And so in a way, and I won't reveal what I'm going to do with that in the game, because one, I don't even totally know, and two, if I did, it'd kind of ruin the game. But the point here being, though, that certainly that reaction can work both ways. The second thing that I would agree with is, Wayne, you're absolutely right that I think faith needs to be defined as, is it a power that has intrinsic or extrinsic value? And what I mean by that is faith itself the power? Is simply your focus of mind, your ability to believe, your unflappability, does that have some kind of power that extends into the spiritual realm? It's almost like a form of white magic or psychic power, psychic here in the literal sense of the word, meaning of the psyche. Is it that kind of thing? Or is it extrinsically valuable where an outside or an external force validates that and empowers that? That it's not my belief in God that is powerful. It's the God in whom I believe that is powerful.
And it's one of those things where we talked a lot about urban fantasy. A lot of urban fantasies go that route of, if you have faith in anything, because that is their way out of having to offend any particular believer.
Bingo. That's one of the next points I want to get to. Let me kind of close off this thought with a different movie example, the one Chris gave, which is really what came to my mind in thinking about this, was a scene from The Mummy, where the mummy is coming after a guy that reminds him of someone who was a stoolie of his back when he was alive the first time. And the guy whips out a cross and starts trying to drive him back in the name of Christ or whatever it is he did. And the mummy just keeps approaching. And then you see the guy take out just one holy symbol after another. And you suddenly get the sense that here's a man who is on some level vacantly sacramentally religious, but really doesn't have faith in anything. But on the flip side, you then later, and that may not have even been the same movie. It might have been in The Mummy 2 or 3.
No, that was in The Mummy, and I know which scene you're talking about. That's actually a very good example. Somebody who believes that, yeah, okay, these things may indeed work. I'm just covering my bases just in case, but I'm not fully invested in what they may really represent.
And I know that was in The Mummy 1. The scene that I was getting to next that I can't remember which movie it was in was where the mummy, I can't remember which pharaoh he was supposed to be. We'll just say Tutankhamun. I have no idea. But sure. But he goes and sees a cat. And because within his mythos, that cat has certain powers over the underworld and things like that, he is freaked out by the presence of the cat and flees the room. Now, the cat didn't do a damn thing. The cat did not throw, you know, a hairball at him, much less a fireball.
Although that would have been funny. And that was actually the original Mummy, yes.
That was also in the first movie. Okay, I couldn't remember which movie that was in. But, you know, he ends up fleeing a guy's house because of the presence of a cat, which is why I sleep safely at night. The guns and dogs are a minor thing, but I have a cat who keeps the mummies away.
You want to see a really, really good mummy movie? Bubba Hotep. I'm not
is
even
that good?
Joking.
I always wanted to see that one.
I'm not even joking. I'm not even being ironic. Bubba Hotep with Bruce Campbell is excellent.
Wayne, I do want to talk about a point you raised, which is one that I think is important, especially when you get out of the realm of traditional fantasy and into urban fantasy, mm-hmm. which is I think it is incumbent upon the game master in setting the game up to explain what the spiritual truth is. And what I mean by that is if we're running a game of World of Darkness and I say to you, OK, I'm going to operate under the precepts that the Orthodox Jews have it right. Well, then by extension, someone who exercises their faith through Shaolin exorcism papers is not going to do anything. Yeah, they're just, as Chris said, they're just kind of pissing in the wind. And so, you know, you have to have the sense of how do things work. And a way that I've seen that worked around in a lot of games is Wayne, exactly what you described. They reduce faith itself to being the power because that way you don't have to answer what may be a difficult or in some cases offensive question of what is religious truth. Now, in the games where I have had to answer that question, it's typically been fairly easy because the groups have either A, been religiously homogenous, or B, only a small number of people were playing faith-based characters. And that subgroup were religiously homogenous. So for the game master to say, okay, this is what the truth is, nothing else is true, was not a problem to the group. And this goes back to the same thing, always know your group, know what their boundaries are. You can talk fiction with pantheons and forgotten realms, and probably no one who's not a total wanker is going to care. But if you've got a Muslim and a Christian in your gaming group, and you tell them one of them is right and the other's wrong, even though it's within the context of the game, they may or may not respond real well to that.
Zoroastrianism is the only true religion in all my games because I like saying Zoroastrianism.
Well, it also goes to you as the game master. If the game you're talking about is one where the being is interceding, then by the nature of someone saying they have faith and this works, you're then implying that that being is both real and does behave and believe in the way that it's being established that they do. I think there's something to that as a GM. In D&D, like I said, they more clearly define these are how these beings act. But in some other games, that may not be the case. So you may actually have to, as the GM, be role-playing the part of a deity on whether this spell works or not.
And that's something that I don't want to do. In a D&D game, I don't care.
Yeah, because it's easy enough. This is a...
They're clowns. I mean, it's cartoon religion.
Nobody at your table is going to be offended because you believe this being does something.
Yeah. But in a modern game where, say, we're playing a vampire, not Vampire Masquerade, but just any game where we're hunting vampires, I don't want to be put in the position where somebody says, okay, my character's a Christian. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. Because of my faith and because I have a cross, the vampires are repelled, right? Like, yeah. Okay, now I want to start doing other stuff. I want to start getting into miracles. I want to start healing people. I want to start doing all these other miracles.
I want to be Moses.
Yeah.
I want to be Elijah.
You know,
whatever, yeah.
Even if the person doesn't take it to an extreme, I don't want to sit there and say, is the God of Israel really balanced in my religion, or should I go for a more New Testament God? And, you know, it's just like, that's not really something I want to get into in a role-playing game.
Well, I find the entire topic incredibly unentertaining, especially among mixed philosophical gaming groups.
And this is why I would add a second question. In addition to, first, the game master needs to survey their party to say, look, how do you guys feel about this topic being dealt with? But I think something else that needs to be expressed clearly, if it's not already written into the setting clearly, is the player should express to the GM. And if the player doesn't express, the GM should ask, what exactly do you expect from Faith? What sort of roles are going to play in your character's life? What sort of impact do you want it to have upon the setting? And make sure that lines up. Because if you have the sense of, look, we're on the brink of Armageddon, and God is capable of anything and loves me a whole lot, well, the game's over. You know, the devil showed up. I prayed. God got rid of the devil. The game is over.
Yeah.
And okay, once again, I'm not commenting on real religion here, but just within the context of a game, obviously that's not a terribly compelling game. Mm-hmm. And so there needs to be this common understanding of what exactly that faith is supposed to accomplish and what the expectations are.
Faith as it appears on a character sheet, not necessarily as it appears in a character write-up.
Precisely. And we'll get to the character sheet here in a minute. I'm still holding on to that. Chad, there's something else you mentioned.
Hellboy.
Other than Hellboy, which is one of the things that I think you have to struggle with in this. How qualified is the game master to roleplay God?
Yeah.
Now, in the case of something like D&D, where
you get X number of spells a day.
You get X number of spells a day. Yeah. That's what the deity does. If the deity is going to appear or interfere in the world in some way, it is an extremely unusual event, and all you've got to do is read a little bit of backstory and personality on the deity, and you get it just fine. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about real modern-day religions, because look, if you even say this prayer got answered and there was no game mechanic that required that, you have just role-played some kind of power. Mm-hmm. You have just role-played God or Dharma or so, you know, some kind of cosmic power here.
I would totally role-play the Buddha.
And the second question is the game master qualified to do it? If I wanted to play a Christian pastor in Hunters Hunted, there are people who it'd be like, well, I don't know that I want to play it under this person because I don't know that they get the religion well enough to even get it close. I'm not saying get it perfect, but...
Or that we understand each other's positions perfectly and don't want to occupy one another's perspectives.
Precisely. It's an uncomfortable and difficult place to go.
Well, and if somebody's playing a Zoroastrian, I'm not sure what I could do with that. I only like to say the word Zoroastrianism. I don't really know very much about it.
Do you then at that point, if you have said Zoroastrianism is part of the setting, just like it would be incumbent upon me in Forgotten
Wikipedia.
Realms.
Wikipedia.
Exactly.
500 BC Persia, you better.
Does Wikipedia become your setting guide in the same way that Face and Avatars or whatever is the...
That's about the long and short of it. I just hope it doesn't get vandalized.
You know, and these are
I'm reading it.
These are all the reasons why a lot of systems and a lot of even fiction goes the route of faith itself has power versus... You know, trying to take that extra step because
I think there's some lines
that some people just don't want to cross. And I'm cool with that.
Even lines that don't want to be crossed or you're not afraid to offend people, that's fine. It's just easier.
Yeah.
You know, it's just easier to say you have 10 out of 15 faith points. That gives you X amount of abilities a day. Let's just get with the
even
role play.
If you're
role play your faith.
Even if you're cool rolling with it, what in the end is more fun? You have faith, it has this number, and that faith itself is something, or worrying about walking on eggshells around, you know, one of your players.
Yeah, I mean,
this, like everything else, just goes to the group and knowing each person around the group and knowing yourself very well before you attempt
but
something.
But
like
in the counterpoint, you are right. And this is, you know, once again, group by group sort of basis. But I think the counterpoint that I could raise to that is which is more interesting. Having a number on paper you make a save against, or someone actually role-playing out adherence to a faith, and instead of just saying,
you know what,
I make a faith check to get rid of the vampire.
You can have 100,000 numbers on a piece of paper. I'm going to role-play out the faith of my character.
Right.
It doesn't matter. I could set the character sheet on fire. I'm still role-playing out my character.
Yes, and I've been in a game with Chad when he was playing a monk-type character trying to win us all over
Tibetan
to order.
Monk, I guess, in this
and
case.
I can tell you that he will role-play it out to the point where you want to reach across the table and strangle him.
That was a good character, man.
We always want to strangle Chad when we game with him.
You hated the character yourself by the end. Your other character you thought was more interesting.
Yeah, he was a tool.
Let me ask you guys one more question on systemless faith before we take a look at some system faith. As a game master, how do you determine when to step in on the negative side to say, no, I don't think your character possesses that faith? How do you go about that? How do you make that sort of determination of, yes, there's a demon in front of you, but where your character's at right now, I'm sorry. You're having a crisis of faith, you're apostatized, whatever you want to use.
It depends on the game.
It does. But what are some loose guidelines you might
honestly
use?
As a game master, I would look at the player and say, I don't think your character is really deep in his faith right now, whatever that faith may be. What do you think? Do you think this is true? It's not my character.
Right.
It's your character. And if you, as a player, unless it's something egregious, like I am a very devout Catholic who really, really enjoys setting preschools on fire with children in them. You know, unless it's something egregious like that, it's not my character. And as a game master, honestly, it's not really my call. I don't care if the players have power, whether it comes from magic, a shotgun, or right. their faith. I'm more concerned with the character, the story, role-playing, right. and the interaction. It's up to the player.
In the last episode, I talked about how I thought really the majority of table-side issues or potential table-side issues should not be dealt with in a role-playing book. This is one of the few places where I think if this is critical to the game's mechanics or its setting, this needs to be dealt with in the rules. Because I think if you don't, you are asking the game masters and players to tread into some very turbulent waters on their own.
You know,
you are basically saying it is up to the game master and players to come to a common agreement on whether God is real and how powerful and willing he is to act.
You know,
and that's a lot to ask from.
There was only one time I stepped in where on someone's faith where I'm like, no, you are wrong. You are going to lose your powers. And that was when Phil was playing a druid and he chased a guy up a tree and he looks at me, he says, I'm like, well, he's not coming down. And he's like, well, I set the tree on fire.
I remember that.
Phil, you're a druid. Druid.
Hey, it could have been one of those like super big old trees in Yellowstone and Tetons that can only drop their pine cones when they're incinerated.
No.
Druids would set those on fire.
Yes. No, they would let nature take its
Well, in fact, as I recall the story, this was a tree in a forest.
It was a tree in a forest. He would set the whole forest on fire. And I said, no.
And if faith, the way we've been describing it, is not critical to the function of a character within the game, I think you can get away with saying, look, let the game masters kind of arbitrate things like burning down the woods is not consistent with druidism.
Yes.
But I think if the system's going to want something out of it, it is incumbent upon them to avoid these arguments by saying in advance, this is how it's going to work. So the debates, the clashes, and so forth are kept to a minimum. Because look,
see, that's
there
why
are two hugely incendiary topics in life, politics and religion. The difference is I've never played a game yet where your political persuasion imbued power outside of role-playing power.
Yeah.
I've never seen anyone, you know, back in the name of Reagan.
So
you live in St. Charles County.
Okay, out here it might work, but this is not a role-playing game.
I have a very simple way of dealing with that. A player comes to me and says, hey, I want to play this religious character. You know, let's work with something. I'm like, fine. You create the religion. You tell me how it works.
Right.
And then if you stray from the path, you tell me that you're straying from the path. And if there's any ill effects from that, why don't you role play out those ill effects?
Right.
And if there's like physical world changing ill effects that come with it, like a voice booms out and says, what are you doing burning down this forest? Why don't you take control of the scene?
Yeah.
And why don't you narrate that out?
I can agree with that to a certain point, but then that to me just seems a little bit extreme. I don't mind, you know, having them. Yep, go ahead, set the tenets of the religion, set this, set the punishments, all of those kinds of things. But the player might want something specific out of that and maybe have some of that taken out of their hands and want to be surprised by maybe their actions. And so, and I like where there's some room for interpretation where the GM can jump in there and maybe, you know, throw a couple of curveballs at the player for what they have in their character do. That kind of setup, it's like a player railroading themselves into where they go and what they want to do.
Not necessarily. I mean, I view role-playing game as a shared world.
Well, sure, it is a shared world.
It is everybody's world, so the player can take control. They come up with this religion. They come up with the god. They can role-play out the god. I don't care. But it's a shared world. I can role-play the god, too. And because I have a stake in the world as well, I'm the game master. I kind of keep things juggling and going. You create this shared experience. As far as a player railroading themselves to give themselves exactly what they want, why not give a player all the things that they want?
I think this is one of those things that if this is going to be an integral part of the game, not only do you have to have a group that is good friends and coherent in this regard, but there has to be a lot of upfront discussion about this is what it is, this is what it isn't. You know, and there's got to be some perspective of this is a game. If I handle your religion a little bit wrong, I'm not trying to
Piss on you as a
human being.
There's a certain aspect of, you know, yeah, it's good to talk things out. Yeah, it's good to know where your players are at and get a consensus. But there is also a danger, especially with fear the boot advice, of being too politically correct. You have to talk to everybody about the religion. You have to talk to everybody if they want torture or rape in the game. You have to talk to everybody about the level of violence. You have to talk to everybody about this expectation or that expectation. You have to talk to every... And it's just like you have to have three gaming sessions just to work through the checklist of what is good and what is bad.
If you know each other and have this discussion one time, you can kind of keep it rolling.
And one other thing we're not touching on here is that in these fantasy worlds, that's not this world. This world, each real religion says this. That fantasy world is a world where other beings exist. In the real world, those beings aren't mentioned in that religion. In this fantasy world, that might not be the case. So, I mean, yes, in each of these games, there also is... You could potentially have real religions and people at the table, but there's also more to that world than just what is in the real world of that religion. And that's something I don't see come up very often when dealing with this. You look at any holy book we have right now for any religion will not mention a vampire. But in a world where vampires have existed and people have always known they've existed.
Many mention familiars and wizards.
In a world where vampires have existed and everyone's always known they've existed, there may be a chapter devoted to it.
Yeah, actually, your comment on vampires isn't entirely true, but I get your point.
Yeah.
I get your point nonetheless.
You get what I'm going for,
And Chad, I do see your point about you can get too cautious and too politically correct, but I think the two things that I would say to kind of hedge that is, first off, really kind of the point of our show is to give advice on how to either A, avoid, or B, handle problems. If it's not a problem... Guess what? You don't need to deal with this.
Yeah.
And my second thing that I would say is, given the amount of time and emotion, everything else that gets invested in a game, while it is just a game, it should never be seen as more. There is still social and you know, whatever state tied up in this. I think it would be better to be a little bit too careful than not quite careful enough. But having said that, I do agree with you that you can go too far off the other end where you are so careful about tippy-toeing around everything that you can't tell a damn story. Because guess what? Having done this podcast for several hundred episodes, I will tell you right now what I've heard said from other people that work in radio, and I'll pass it down to you as truth. You cannot say anything without offending somebody.
Oh, yeah.
The only thing that helps to your gaming table is there's less people, and therefore you have less potential individuals to offend.
Yeah, it's just this is one particular topic. I have a hard and fast rule. I will not talk about politics or religion with people that I work with, because I have to interact with them even if I vehemently disagree with them on a personal issue. Those are two topics that it's more likely to run into people that you have opposing views with that you cannot reconcile.
Right.
And
they're
that's
neither
why
necessary nor helpful to polite conversation. I don't really think they're necessary or helpful to a role-playing game.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why I think
I've
this case...
I've never had politics or religion
unless
come up
you're playing
RPG,
politics
or
religion.
Forever.
I mean, that's why I think in this case...
Right, who plays this game?
If you're playing a game where this is going to come in, I think it is worth taking the time to talk about it ahead of time because it's one of those hot-button issues.
All right, to close this one out, let's bookend it with the other type of faith, which is the faith that does have a game mechanic. And we've got a couple games that we're using as examples, not because we want to get into nitpicking systems here, but just because these provide some different approaches for handling faith in a mechanical way. Now, as we said earlier in this episode, I think the advantage of these systems is the fact that they take some of the eggshells out of the equation. They predefine things that otherwise might be controversial or difficult at the table.
Deadlines.
But conversely, they can also be a bit limiting. Whenever you put rules down for anything, the game master and players should certainly never feel bound by them like iron chains, but they do become sort of an arbiter of how things work. All right, so I'm going to give a couple examples. Wayne's going to give an example, and then I think Chris is going to give an example. And the two I'm going to give should be no surprise to anyone. I have sitting here with me Hunters Hunted, which is the hunter game from Old World Darkness. Then I have the most recent hunter game, Hunter the Vigil. In Hunters Hunted, they took a pretty straightforward approach to it. You, as a regular human being, had access to a limited set of powers. These were things that they kind of feared, well, a normal person without having anything specifically otherworldly about them could do. And that included things like psychic powers, hedge magic, and amongst those was faith. And you could spend points to buy faith for your character and then to advance that faith to higher levels. And it was really a pretty static number. There was not a whole lot given in there about how that faith waxes and wanes, apart from, you know, the typical advice of, well, the game master and player ought to keep track of how that faith is waxing and waning. But the faith gave specific powers. For example, each level in faith you had could be used as a die to try and drive back spiritual forces. So if like a vampire charges me, I could lock wills with him where his will against my faith, and I could attempt to push him back. If you got to really high levels of faith, you could start doing all kinds of stuff like consecrating holy ground, putting blessings upon things. I mean, you got some really powerful stuff that you could use against the supernatural. And I realize I'm doing just kind of the quick bird's eye view of these systems here. But in Hunter the Vigil, they gave a slightly different framework, which is they set forth that you have a morality. And as you do things that fit within a moral framework, that morality can kind of wax and wane. It goes up and down. And there's different circumstances and different severities of how that faith goes up and down. And then what happens is you can attempt to sort of invoke that faith, and the dice that you will roll will be modified based on how faithful you have been to your precepts. So for example, and I'm really simplifying things here, so if you're a World of Darkness fan, chill. I'm just keeping this as simple as I can. But it's something like you go to church, you engage in the sacraments, you allow a bad guy to get away to avoid hurting an innocent. And so your morality creeps up. And as a result, when you go to actually cash that out to attempt to strike down a vampire in the name of Christ, you get situational bonuses to that attempt to exercise your faith. And similarly, if you do things that offend those precepts, that sort of decays, and these things get more and more difficult for you to do. And so it does sort of abstract a moral framework.
It sounds more like that falls under the, you know, you're doing things to make me happy, so I'm giving you more aspect.
I would not say that's totally inaccurate. If you read the fluff text, they were going for more than that. They were going for the idea that faith leads to works. Works are the expression of faith. And therefore, we're going to use works as the temperature taker of your faith. But you are right in that how that actually plays out or could play out.
How it looks mechanically.
Yeah, how it looks mechanically would be the reverse, that it's almost an impersonal adherence to ceremony or to precepts as opposed to what's actually in your heart. Now, I do know from the fluff text that was not their intent, but they were just trying to find some way to quantify and put boundaries upon what's otherwise a purely internal, personal trait. So, Wayne, the example you were going to give, how does Dresden handle it?
Okay, so it handles it a couple of different ways. First, there's a skill, it falls under the skill tree, but it's actually just a core part of your character, called conviction. And that is the aspect of just having faith. So that's a part of it.
Okay.
That's the same skill you would use if you have faith in a deity or if you're a wizard casting a spell and you need faith in your own magic. So that deals with that aspect of it. Then they have archetypes built in. Past that even
I know.
Here for, if I can't help
I
it.
I know.
They have archetypes built in that are True Believer and Champion of God. And they go through different levels of this. You know, you have faith over time. You've built up faith. You believe you have these abilities, for lack of a better word. Things like, you know, your home is more protected because you have faith and you live there. Your touch can actually burn things that are weak to faith because you have that faith. And for those kind of faiths, you specifically have to have faith in something that exists and is unknowable. You can't say, I have faith in my gun and have it work. No, it has to be something that actually exists and is a power, a deity or, you know, something. But that gives you a certain level of, you have faith, you can do things, consecrate ground, things like that. But then they take it one level higher, and the champion of God is actually somebody that has been called forth. This is somebody that's been called to do the work, the holy warrior. And they have
St. George type.
Yeah, they have not only the true believer's abilities, they have other things that they can do as well, because, you know, they're not just a true believer. You can have a little old lady in her house that's a true believer that can fight a vampire, right? Versus here is somebody that is a warrior that is going to go out with a sword and fight a dragon.
And that sounds similar in the end, and certainly not in the way you got there, but in the end result, similar to how Hunter's Hunted handled it, where in the same way, yes, you could have somebody who is absolutely infirm in mind and body, but nonetheless, through faith, can exercise powers. And at the higher level, I was skimming this real quick, you can remove an evil aura from an area. You can get a sign from God to inspire you. You can cause a vampire to collapse with guilt. You can attempt to convert someone. You can exorcise demons. You can simply have so much faith that you ignore damage, that basically you believe you are so called by God to kill this vampire that when he attempts to harm you, it simply does nothing to
and
you.
See, some of those are abilities that are in here as well. The spiritual guidance is something that's in here. You can pray for guidance. And then there is a mechanic in there for, you know, for that to actually grant you something, grant either knowledge or a be in the right place at the right time kind of thing.
See, I like the one where you said your mechanical faith ability has the ability to cause the vampire to collapse in guilt. That's really cool. I don't want that to be a mechanic. I want to role play that out. I don't even want it to be where I roll the dice or do the whatever, and okay, that happens. Now role play that out.
Well,
I want to just role play that and see if that comes
I don't
naturally.
Have a problem and with it, and here's why. Because I think there are two ways there. One is you can role play convincing the vampire what they're doing is wrong and they fall from guilt. But this is a spiritual act. The spirit of God overwhelms this vampire and convicts him in an external way. Mm-hmm. This was not a change in the vampire. This was a, so to speak, magical attack upon their mind.
Yeah.
And so
what would it do if it was a vampire that had never killed anyone?
The rules are a little bit.
Feel bad about jacking off.
I don't want to get too much into the specific rules. All right, but
don't aim that power at me, please.
Chris, did you have one you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, going back to the 90s, the original Deadlands, the character type of the Blessed, which they're very upfront about the fact that these people are, you know, following the Christian denomination of the time. And so it lays out the various tenets of what's going on for that religion, and then what happens if the character violates, you know, some of those rules, and what they have to do to try and essentially either have it be noticed or have it mattered. And they do have to make an attribute roll, and there's a certain target number threshold, and if they fail, they start to lose faith points, which then affects their ability to actually invoke the powers that they have. And then they have to go and do various things to atone to try and get those things back. And so there's specific mechanics covering that and the boons then that come with it. You know, you certainly can have a character who can roleplay things very well, but in this particular case, since so much of what he does is tied up in mechanics, I think it is kind of nice to have some of that stuff in there to kind of gauge the strength of those powers based upon how that character behaves.
You know, it sounds like, generally speaking, the rules that we've talked about take one of two approaches, which is either they measure faith in a vacuum, that, like in Hunter's Hunted, faith is a standalone stat that is really tied to nothing other than how the character is built and maybe some role-playing situations, versus most of these games, where they actually create faith as a secondary effect, that there is some amount of morality, virtue, conviction, whatever you want to call it, and faith then becomes an expression of that. And as your morality, virtue, conviction go up and down, then what your faith will produce basically mirrors that. But it kind of, it splits that just a little bit.
You know what system I like? I like Dogs in the Vineyard. Because Dogs in the Vineyard has no spiritual aspect to it whatsoever, but it is a deeply faith-based game.
Right.
You're playing Mormons in a sort of West that's slanted a little side. It's a little, the West that never was, how to describe it. And part of the game, part of the mechanics of the system is a lot like Dresden, where you create a city and you define all that sort of stuff. Well, in Dogs in the Vineyard, you create a town. And you create the sort of moral and spiritual barometer of that town. Your character, because you're this sort of Mormon enforcer, right? You are the judges of the faithful. You speak the truth, right? Again, it's not spiritual at all. This is the faith of it, so to speak, the religion of it. And it's really cool because while you are the law of the faith, you are not the law of the land, and your faith and the law of the land will conflict with each other. And like, if you pull a little old lady out of her house because she's not faithful enough and shoot her and kill her, that's illegal. But it is within your religion. All that is mechanic. Again, you create that town and you create that faith. The faith is all role played. It's not about fireballs and holy water and casting people out and stuff.
I have both played and run games that were along those lines where faith was very abstracted out and in the background. Mm-hmm. I remember several years back running Epoch Risos, hard sci-fi game, mm-hmm. no magic, spiritual questions are not answered. It's a non-theistic game. It's not an atheistic game. It's not a theist. It just doesn't deal with those issues. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of running this game, and I won't name the person just because I don't have their permission to do so, but there was someone in the game who themselves was not a deeply religious person by any stretch of the imagination. In the middle of the game, this person asked, is there a God in this universe? Does God exist in this universe? And the question really took me aback because it was, one, the source, and then two, it was like, I don't know. I mean, the setting really doesn't deal with that. And I kind of thought about it for a minute, and the question kind of came back like, why are you asking?
Yeah.
And the answer was just because, well, there are some truths about the universe, which I don't want to get into because it'd be a huge bore to anyone who's not familiar with the universe. But there's some truths about the universe that make...
Not Epoch of Risos. That's really interesting. We're talking our universe is really boring.
But there's some truths about Epoch that make the future look pretty bleak. And she basically said, if there is not something divine that has guaranteed us a fate or whatever, or an existence, we're doomed.
Yeah.
There is no future. And it was like, I had never really thought about it that way. But I think to some extent, yes, faith or your cosmology can affect any game. But in the course of this episode, what I really wanted to tackle, and I believe we did a pretty good job of, is tackling those where it is an actionable part of the game. Whether it's designed through role player rules and enacted through role player rules, it does something very real. It really does drive somebody back.
Yeah, if faith is going to drive back a creature, then you need to have some agreement about faith.
All right.
And that's why I wanted to bring up Dogs in the Vineyard too, because I think that faith can be more than just driving the vampire back too. It could be in a role playing setting, a really heavy, palpable motivator for the characters.
Look at real history. Faith has driven people to do unbelievably wonderful and horrible things
in equal measure.
Yeah, and in the face of very bizarre odds. And so certainly even without any true game power, faith is a great part of a character.
Yes.
But from this particular episode, I wanted to approach it from the standpoint of the game, not the character. All right, so I think we'll wrap this one up here. This went longer than I had hoped for one simple reason, which I believed
it went longer.
For those of you that don't know already, I will be out on the Gamer Cruise all of next week. And so as a result, I will be pretty absent from the forums, and even high importance emails will go unanswered. they'll be treated like every other email I get. So
Cruise isn't going to stop the Power 16, though.
Oh, no. The Power 16 will be set up. It'll be set up before I leave on the cruise. It'll be running while I'm on the cruise. That's
right. It is going forward.
That's a
wild beast that can't be stopped.
Yeah, and we are going to record a second episode tonight, so there will be an episode next week. Just don't expect to hear anything from me again until sometime in early April. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya. April 1st, episode 200.
Yeah. Who's that big of a fool? This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.